Good morning, everybody. I want to thank our distinguished speakers and panelists for joining us here today. And I particularly want to thank Chris and Vita from Synapse for doing so much work to organize this symposium. And the effort that you put into this and the leadership that you provide for on clean energy issues in central New York and Syracuse is really astounding. So let's have a round of applause for Synapse. And first and foremost, of course, I want to thank Rhea Jaser for the incredible vision, the incredible work that she's put into these really extraordinarily thoughtful, productive, and positive discussions around clean energy. She's put Syracuse, Central New York on the map with these conferences, brought together so many stakeholders, really made the area's leadership on clean energy known throughout the country. Rhea, you've been an incredible friend to me, and I can't thank you enough for everything that you've done. So let's have a big round of applause for Rhea. And our theme, of course, today is a look back at the last 10 years in New York and in the country and in the world on clean energy, and a look forward on the next 10 years. And one difference for me between today and 10 years ago is 10 years ago I didn't need reading glasses, but today I do, so they're going to come on and off. Hope that isn't distracting. And we distributed 600 note cards to the audience, and I want to recognize Tom Amidon and his students from SUNY ESF. Please stand up so we can thank you for collecting and organizing all the questions. We got about 300 questions back, and they're far-ranging, folks, so get ready. Everything from big-picture questions about the role of culture and efficiency in renewables, how far we can go to the smart grid, to energy efficiency, to flywheel technology, and everything else in between. So let's get going. And to kick it off, our first question is from a member of the audience who was at Cornell last week and heard Professor Tony Ingraffia talk about the work that he and others, Mark Jacobson at Stanford, have been doing on as part of the Solutions Project, and they've developed a vision for 100% renewables here in the United States and here in New York. They've put together a specific plan, which is their vision on how New York could get to 100% renewable energy for electricity, industrial, transportation, everything by 2050. So it's an ambitious plan, and the question for any and all of you to jump into is, can we get to 100% renewable energy in New York? What's the timetable, and what's the key barrier that we have to overcome to do that? And why don't we start with you, Ashok?
Okay. So the short answer is it doable? Yes, technically yes. So the challenge is then how to operationalize it, the cost issues and everything else. I mean, it is not easy at all. And I think all the things we talked about earlier are the things that put us on that path. So to me, as important as that goal is for 2050, it's what we do in the next 5 years. That's going to be the most important to set us on the path to that target. So, and clearly energy efficiency, again, has to be the biggest part of that goal. If we're going to try to get to 100% renewable future in any time frame, we can't waste a third or half of the electricity we generate, right? So we've got to build in the efficiency first, then you got to start figuring out how these technologies scale up. And I think the challenge of moving the transportation sector to all renewables at the same time, and industrial, and if the plan is also calling for no nuclear, that means shutting down the existing nuclear plants and meeting that need. So it's a tough task to get there, But that doesn't mean we shouldn't be aiming for it. We should just figure out, again, what do we need to do in the next 3 years, 5 years, 10 years to get there? Because I think that's what's going to be the most important issue in terms of getting to any target we set. If it's 80 by 50 or 100 by 50, no matter what that target is, what's the trajectory we're going to get on? And we got to get, I mean, the McKinsey cost curve shows that all the negative cost stuff that we need to do right now is where we should start.
In terms of barriers, I'd put them in three categories: technological, economic, and siting. Start with technological. We really need to find the storage technology which will allow us to use renewables in that sort of efficient manner to meet 100% of our electricity. They can't all be intermittent. Without storage, it's going to be very, very almost impossible to get to 100%. So that's a big hurdle that needs to be moved through. Economic, there's a cost associated with it in the short term. Tremendous long-term benefits, but there are costs associated with the short term. Raising electricity bills is never a popular thing. I've used the statistics since I've been a commissioner. We have over 1 million New Yorkers over 60 days in arrears in their electricity bills, and raising prices another whatever percentage to make this happen is a barrier to that. Third, and this is kind of an unfortunate one, is siting. We're seeing already in terms of finding places, localities that are willing to have wind farms, for example, in their community. There's an awful lot of opposition, whether you want to call it NIMBYism or whatever you want to call it. There's a lot of opposition to a lot of technologies being in sight of somebody's home or business. And to get to 100%, that's a lot of land use that's going to have, whether it's solar, wind, there's going to be a lot of land associated with that. And perhaps, again, the difficulty of getting new transmission lines, if you try to build the stuff upstate, downstate, they're incredibly unpopular and face a lot of opposition. So we need to overcome some of these barriers, but that should be our goal and objective, is to get wean ourselves off of the fossil fuel technology and try to get a sustainable future.
Dan, anything to add? 100% renewables in California, maybe.
So let me kind of echo, you know, what Ashok and Gary have said, that there are, you know, it's the right direction. It's, you know, a goal that technically is, you know, we can see how to grasp it, although storage, et cetera, is something of a problem still to be solved, or enabling technology still to be developed. I think the, you know, we can talk about the long-term picture and how to get there. We are also focused on, okay, what would we do now? And as we direct our agenda at NYSERDA, and as part of the team of agencies around the state that are focused on this, I think we see two main areas of focus. One is, if it's possible, and a lot of things are possible, we know that today, you know, we still observe an issue of, you know, demand generation. You know, there are people who could be, you know, achieving benefits from solar on their rooftop or energy efficiency in their building or their enterprise, and it's not happening. And, you know, it can't be because they're all foolish or, you know, are thinking poorly about the issue. It has to be because there are barriers, and our job is to identify and unlock the demand by setting the barriers aside. So, you know, they're creating the demand for this is, you know, a big job. And the other thing from a state, et cetera, policy point of view is that whenever you think about the numbers that are involved in a plan like, you know, the ambitious and admirable solutions project, the investment required is big. You know, it's a lot of money that has to be put to work. And it can't all come from the public coffer. So the question is, okay, how do we get others to pitch in? So as we think about kind of our next steps along that worthy goal, we're you know, we're worried about storage and we're trying to foster technology and we're trying to improve the, you know, the technology availability and the technical economics, but we're also thinking about, okay, how do we solve the demand generation problem and how do we solve the, can we get others to invest alongside us problem? And that's tactically what we're trying to do.
Just to add two quick things. One, to the extent that public dollars are involved, they've got to head in the direction as much as we can of the cheapest opportunities in terms of clean energy. And to Ashok's point, efficiency has got to be the first dollar. That's the cheap stuff. That's the low-hanging fruit. As I like to say, it's low-hanging fruit that grows back because we're always inventing new efficiency technologies. So yes, on renewables, we got to push them hard, but to the extent your dollars, our dollars are being spent, make sure a lot of that is headed in lowering demand first and foremost. The second point I would make is we've got to do this being very mindful of public and ratepayer support. If we lose public support in doing this, if we lose ratepayer support in doing this, it becomes much harder. Germany is really struggling right now because in many ways they have lost some of that support. We heard from our colleague a little while ago. Ontario is now struggling because they've lost some support. So yes, pushing forward, but you got to do it in a smart way that is respectful of sustainability, reliability, and public support.
Jose? Ken, sorry.
Yeah, I was just going to, you know, add, certainly would complement that as the goal. We have to set far-reaching goals. That's the only way to change behavior and get the right policies. Having said it, if we just go at it from a supply standpoint, I think for the reasons Gary mentioned, you know, technology, siting, cost, we won't get there. I think the key is to look at the 2050 demand forecast and say, how much can we take that demand forecast down? And really just re-echo the comments around energy efficiency. We need to completely rethink energy efficiency in the home, energy efficiency in businesses, any efficiency, energy efficiency on our own systems, just the way we've rethought solar and wind and all of the renewables. So for me, it's the demand side that will be the determining factor as to whether we get all the way there.
Just a quick comment on the on setting the importance of setting targets. Have them be 100%, 80%. I think it's important for us to set targets. At the national scale, some of you may or may not be familiar. The Department of Energy sponsored a study a few years ago. What would 80% renewable generation portfolio look like for the nation? And that study really kind of opened people's minds to think about where the opportunities are. And I think, as others alluded, the gaps that are out there, both in terms of technology, of course, financing, siting, many other opportunities, and understanding the interplay between these technology sources and how they can work together and, of course, fulfill aggressive targets, I think it's an important recognition. I think the comments on land use, siting are highly, highly important. I think all of these technologies have significant attributes, but at the same time, we must recognize what they can cause as well, right? So I think we need to think about it as a whole holistic system, understand the challenges, but I think setting a target, independent of what the number may be, is really, really important. I'll share with you a very quick study data point that really brings this home, at least for us, and so forth. Several of you, maybe in the room, may have heard of a study that we did a few years ago, and I'll put it into real terms, called 20% Wind Energy by 2030. That study was done in the 2006 timeframe, and of course, if you've tracked the wind industry, just as a data point, people believed that that was hugely aspirational. The industry that we have today had not arrived. There were significant challenges, oppositions in terms, can we scale? Can this be done? Can the grid absorb high penetrations of renewables in a reliable, resilient way? And today we have exceeded the growth patterns projected in that study. That's not to say that it was easy. That's not to say that there weren't challenges, but it is to say that through technology, through awareness, through learning, this nation has proven that we can do pretty impressive things if we all come together. And I think that's the purpose of today. And I think these kinds of targets are important and really serve a purpose.
Great. Bob?
Just maybe a footnote, and I agree with all that's been said, but I think key to accomplishing the goal is going to be engaging the public, getting the public to buy in, to avoid some of the opposition. Because I think, you know, you got 600 people in this room and we're all very engaged. but I don't think the general public really is yet engaged in the subject. We got to do a better job educating them. I agree, conservation is the low-hanging fruit. We're only going to get that conservation if we can demonstrate to the public that it's in their best interest long-term to get us there. So I think we've got to do a better job engaging the public to meet that goal.
Any thoughts, Dan?
Okay, yeah. In terms of, from the Canadian disposition, you know, as you saw from some of the graphs, you know, they're already at 60% generation capacity in hydro. And if you consider hydro renewable, they're there. And certainly the local jurisdictions, Manitoba and Quebec, you're on the order of 95 to 97% hydro. So it's quite strong on the Canadian side. At the same time, on the Ontario example, it is really a challenge. And trying to, I mean, that's a certain kind of program. I'm not saying that other policies and programs, particularly around financing, would suffer the same situation. But it is a really challenging process in Ontario at the moment. And they're still looking, we're still looking at a 46% renewable base by 2025. So it's an aggressive challenge. Anyone who has the storage issue is highly, highly priced at the moment in Ontario. If anyone has any ability to advance that for Ontario, I think you'd find a welcome ear at the moment.
So next set of questions. Gary mentioned the Utility 2.0 proceeding that the Public Service Commission is about to launch. To look at what's the future of utility regulation in New York State, how do we make utility regulation compatible with our clean energy goals in New York State, compatible with consumer and low-income consumer needs. And this is a discussion that's going on across the country. As utilities look into the future, see energy efficiency taking hold, see rooftop solar coming on strong, although still at a low level percentage-wise. There was a big paper that came out from the Utility Trade Association about disruptive technologies. So the question is, how can we keep our utilities and our utility grids strong while also meeting these other important goals? And how can we do utility regulation in a smarter way? So we have a bunch of questions about that, and basically I've summarized them, but there are also many questions from the audience about net metering, which is a small part, but an important part of this discussion, and questions about where net metering is in New York. What's the prospect for community net metering, which allows the meter to run backwards from community systems as well as individual rooftops? And also questions about how net metering works in terms of the impact on other consumers who don't have PV systems on their roof. So we have a big picture question and a series of smaller questions, and Ken, can we start with you?
Sure. I think on the first question, I really think it's a combination of leveraging what already works well in New York regulation, but then advancing those regulations to address what we're covering here. So right now, I think, you know, under Gary's leadership and now with Chair Zibelman, the New York regulatory framework is forward-looking. So when the utilities submit plans, we submit 5-year capital plans, 15-year capital plans, and we file a rate agreement, it doesn't take just the past, it actually goes well into the future to assess what the right investment levels are. That is fundamental is to making sure that whoever's making the investment has a long-term view. I mentioned in the United Kingdom, we have an 8-year forward look. So you could actually say, where do you want to be 8 years from now? What are the investments you need now? So I would absolutely leverage the strength in utility rate making around capital planning and long-term view. I think what needs to be adapted now is none of us know what the future holds. So if I were to have set my capital plans 2 years ago just, I wouldn't have had any flood-prone gas pipes. I learned all that, unfortunately, from Sandy. I wouldn't have had substations raised to make them more resilient from some of the from the floods. I've learned that since then. And I'm about to learn a lot more these next few years, is to build in more annual flexibility to those plans so that whatever I submit as my last rate filing is the placeholder, but then there's many opportunities to adapt and to move it forward. I think secondly, there needs to be incentives. You need to have incentives to bring in non-utility players to the market. You know, utilities alone will not solve this challenge. Our role is to make the backbone strong and resilient and to bring everyone else and to integrate. I think by giving utilities and other players incentives to participate in the market, I absolutely think we will get to those solutions. So it's a combination of staying with what works, but now, given all the changes, being much more nimble, much more flexible to adapt those plans going forward. I'd be happy to take the net metering questions as well, but maybe I'll stay on the first for now.
Sure. And let me actually, while I've got you, Ken, I forgot one question that was related to this, which is, do New York State utilities need to be monopolies? And how related is that question to the clean energy issues that we're talking about?
I mean, it's probably not intuitive to folks, but you know, if you took all the New York utilities, not just National Grid, there are tens of millions of dollars of investments that have already been made. And you really have an issue whereby the main cost is either digging up the street to put the pipes in or laying those lines. I don't think a model where others then do that same function has any economic benefit. I haven't seen it work anywhere. Having said that, there are many parts of the current utility system which absolutely can and should be opened up for competition. But the fundamental role of a utility is we already have the assets, we have the expertise, we have the skill to run and modernize the system. I, in my heart of hearts, believe that's the role of the utility. As you get beyond that, by all means, whoever can do it the best, the cheapest, and in the most advanced way, it should be competitive between utilities and others, and that's what creates open markets.
Great. And actually, for efficiency, why don't you say a few words about net metering, Ken, and then we'll pass the mic down.
Yeah, I think net metering is actually a much bigger issue than perhaps we're even discussing. And I think for me, the key is the glide path. If you just take an extreme example, if in 2050 everyone is on distributed generation, but there's no charge to the utility, there'll actually be no funding for the backbone that's needed to run all that distributed generation. So there has to be what's called rate payer equity over time. And I think right now, the way it's happening is where the meters are spinning backwards, we're bringing in communities where possible. I think that's fine at this point in time. But I think as we start to get further penetration, we need to have a glide path to make sure you match the cost to the benefits. So any customer who provides a benefit to the utility and to our greater absolutely should be fully compensated for that benefit. Likewise, any customer who derives a benefit from the system whereby they're taking the power at the right time in that glide path needs to fund those costs. I don't think right now is that time. We need to stimulate the market. We need to get further penetration. But if we're to achieve these goals, very quickly that dial is going to turn on us. And if you look at other countries, you know, there's a lot of good examples. In Germany, the cost of electricity is 4 to 8 times higher than it is here in New York because they really never got their arms around the glide path. We are where they were 10 years ago. Now is our chance to set the 5 or 10 year glide path, and how do you gradually dial up the changes? Fortunately, it works well because at the same time, the cost of installation will come down far more whenever that changes in net metering. So I'm not at all advocating for a change right now. I'm advocating for a 10-year plan, a 5-year plan, as the installation costs come down, as the markets truly become competitive, to make sure that the utilities are reimbursing customers where appropriate, and that customers are funding utility investments where appropriate.
Okay, Shoke.
A lot of questions.
So I agree that we're going to always need a distribution network on the electric and gas side that's going to have to be a monopoly that is regulated, and therefore the question then ends up being how do you invest in it, recover the costs, and have it work with lots of other things that are going to happen on the customer side. So we're not going to have parallel wires and pipes going to people's homes. It's a monopoly, and we do need the grid. I don't believe it's about everybody going off the grid somehow. And so to the extent that you need a grid and use it well, then the question is how do you pay for it and how do you size it properly? Because the other thing that's going to have to happen here is, you know, what is needed in terms of the grid and sizing it correctly and then recovering the cost over time, over a longer period of time, so we're thinking about it in a very smart way. Most of you understand that if we keep reducing our demand through efficiency, we keep generating our own electricity, there are fewer kilowatt hours over which the distribution company can then recover its fixed costs. So this is about how you recover your fixed costs as you have fewer and fewer, less and less throughput over your system, right? And, you know, we have
on the energy efficiency side for years supported what's called revenue decoupling mechanism as a strategy, and tying that with performance incentives. So you have, you know, you have the ability to recover your costs, your fixed costs, and you're able to adjust your rates as your sales decline. Okay, there's definitely a rate impact, but again, there's an issue focusing on rates versus bills. So there are mechanisms like that that we can do in the near term and are doing in many states, and we should make sure we keep doing them. But I think over time, that doesn't get you there either, and you're gonna need to figure out really how should these fixed costs be recovered, and those that are self-generating, how much of those fixed costs should be recovered from those customers, and how should they be recovered, either as fixed charges or volumetric. We believe even those charges that are to be recovered should be recovered volumetrically rather than as fixed, as to provide a further incentive for people to keep saving. And so this is rate design, maybe more detail than we need to get into, but I do think this is a good conversation, a very important one that we are all engaged in terms of figuring out how to make sure the investment happens, how do you make sure you recover those costs, how do you make sure the system is sized properly, and you recover those costs on a fixed cost basis versus volumetrically.
Let me just go back to the basics for a minute and build on what you guys have both said. Utilities are private investor-owned entities. Their job is to make money for their shareholders. The traditional way that they made money for their shareholders was to grow, sell more electricity, build more infrastructure, get the regulator to bless it, get a return on their investment, and that's how they grew. So we were sending, so that made energy efficiency the opposite of where they wanted to go, because it reduced their revenues. That made on-site generation the enemy of their revenues. So traditionally, regulators had encouraged growth, 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 and not surprisingly, the investor-owned utilities initially were leery of these energy efficiency programs, et cetera. That's where we started introducing things as a show. We've had decoupled electricity rates for 10 years in New York. That takes away that incentive, that growth is the way that you go. We still haven't taken away the incentive of still kind of, the only other way is to build infrastructure out. There's enough infrastructure that needs to be fixed. We don't need to add new. How do we get the incentives that they then embrace on-site generation, renewable resources, energy efficiency as part of the core of their business, and can, dirty word, profit from it, because that's their ultimate objective. That's what regulators need to do more of. That's what Utility 2.0 is a bit of example of. The example I use, if a business wants to put in an on-site generator at this point in time, there are lots of vendors they can talk to. The one group that they really can't talk to in terms of buying the equipment is the utility, because we've said we don't want you in that business. We need to rethink some of that. Maybe they should be allowed to be in that business and profit on that, because then it's a level playing field between on-site generation and them selling generation. All these things need to be rethought, and we need to get, it's all about getting the incentives correct to get the behavior of the company aligned with the social objectives you're trying to achieve.
New York State has done a good job and is ahead of many states in making sure that utilities have the incentive, your investor-owned utilities have the incentives to invest in energy efficiency. So further work on that is important, but you've taken a good first step here in this state. Further work is necessary in the case of this on-site distributed generation, as you just said. But there are models out there for doing it, and through your Public Service Commission and working with utilities and working with advocates, I think you're moving along well. On net metering, the good news is there are many, many models out there, many in sort of the experimental stages in figuring out how to do net metering correctly. It's controversial because essentially utilities see the increasing use of distributed generation as something of a threat to their investment model. They are investor-owned utilities, and to the extent that they're less and less in the business of electricity, and there are others who are more and more, they're making less money. But there are ways to deal with that.
just as there have been ways to deal with energy efficiency. So all over the country, there are experiments underway. Small one, but very interesting, is down in Texas. Austin Energy has done some very interesting work to figure out how you'd accurately calculate the cost of the utility, the benefits to the ratepayers, the cost of the ratepayers, how this all comes together when more and more distributed generation gets put on people's roofs and their businesses. Finally, we've heard the word storage a lot this morning, and it is important from a regulatory standpoint that we begin to think through that. California has taken a step through the legislature, working with the Public Utility Commission there, to get investor-owned utilities to start investing in storage, and again, make some money in doing so. That program is off and running, and I think that's going to help accelerate the deployment, the cost-effective deployment of storage for electricity in California, and hopefully we'll see other states taking similar steps.
So I'm going to speculate about what might be coming, and I see kind of three topics of, you know, debate and inquiry and experimentation. So one is commodity price. So right now the model is, you know, what the utility delivers gets priced on the basis of, you know, cents per unit volume. And we kind of know that that's not actually the value that the utility delivers, right? And we talk about the delivery, the utility being responsible for reliability, resilience, et cetera. So we already know that we're sort of charging for something that's not everything we deliver, and we're delivering for things that we're not really we're delivering things that we're not really charging for. So I think that's, we can see that, and I think people are going to think about ways to deal with that reality. And that's true as you think about the distributed generation side too. If you think about what what's going to happen on in the utility 2.0, if someone can island, well, what's the value of that? Well, how are we going to figure out how to do that? If you can do storage, what's the value? Is it ride through in an emergency? Is it peak or time shifting for load management? The whole set of demand response, by the way, demand response isn't just one flavor. It's 72 hours advance notice or 15 second response. So I think there's going to be testing of, what are the values that are being provided, and how do we want to get compensated for them? Because if it's not the utility that's providing them, it's someone else, and they're going to want compensation too. So I think, I think we're beyond the, I suspect we'll be beyond the profit is a dirty word thing. The second related expectation I have is, we'll be exploring, different types of what you might call regulatory technique, right? So there's talk about, performance-based rate making. I think it's fair to describe the RIIO model as that, and so forth. We'll see that being worked on too. And the final thing is, I think there's relatedly a task of what you might call market design, which is, okay, we know that it's not clear today that automatically the right people to do everything are utilities on the other side of the meter. They might be. In many cases, we think they will be. But what about the others? I know this is a fast-moving world of technology, and so it's always risky to name company names because the list in 3 years is going to be different. But if you sort of imagine, okay, let's have O-Power do this and Internoc do that and project developers with Ice Energy do a third thing, how are we going to, how do we create the rules in the marketplace that let them make money and have access to the home, but leave the utilities, with enough degrees of freedom to do what they need to do and so forth. So there's all those things happen. And I believe that to net metering is that as you think about those issues, you will start to find alternatives to worrying about, net metering in its current form. I mean, net metering to me is at least partially a direct result of the commodity price approach. And as we figure out different alternatives, I think part of that challenge goes away. So I don't know what the answer is going to be, but I think we can expect what the avenues of inquiry are going to be.
And thank you. And let me just ask the going to the community net metering question. Let me just ask the New Yorkers: is that on the table? What's the status of any legislation?
I can truthfully say I don't think I know the answer.
I think it's on the table, and if it's not, it should be. And just the 10-second history here is Ashok and I worked with many of the other folks in this room on New York's first net metering bill 20 years ago, which then was limited to residential, had a very small cap. Over the years, it's expanded out to other categories, including, I think, commercial and agricultural. The cap has gone up. There are definitely some next steps. So we've got some of our local elected officials in the room. If you care about community net metering, you should be talking to them as well as all these folks.
And we'll have a report out actually in May that's going to look at community net metering in various states around the U.S. among other state policies.
Okay, any other thoughts about the utility of the future? Bob?
Yeah, again, just to kind of add to what's been said, maybe we should look at other models that have worked. I know the energy delivery system is more complex in some cases than telecommunications, but the telecommunications industry has become deregulated. And new players have come into the field. Some of the existing regulated telephone companies have been able to get into the field as well. So I think we should look at some models that have worked, and maybe there's some things from the telecommunication industry we can learn. But I also think, and I think Gary touched on it, I think the utilities should be allowed to play in the unregulated environment. You got to have a Chinese wall, I guess, between the regulated side and the unregulated side of the business. But why shouldn't utilities be able to invest in microgrids, in CHP, and things of that nature, and recover some of that investment? It may take some of the pressure off the ratepayers on the other side of the equation.
Could I just make one comment on the telecommunications industry?
Because very briefly, Gary. Okay.
Some of it's been successful and some of it haven't. Could I just have a show of hands how many people still have a landline out there? Well, exactly. That's going to be my point. About half the room. And we do need to maintain the landlines, and it's expensive to do so, and they keep losing customers, 50,000 a month. I'm very afraid that one day we're going to end up with the grandmother in Speculator, New York, that has a bill of $1 billion because she's the last one left with a landline in New York.
It's going to be my mother.
So we do have to be cognizant.